If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems, too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and, of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable, too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Esta semana tendremos un episodio especial en inglés con Peter Singer, el autor de un libro que se llama Liberación Animal, filósofo y activista australiano. La próxima semana regresaremos con la programación usual en español. 48 years ago, the world was going through troubled waters. All eyes were on Saigon, America's last ditch in Vietnam. After 10 years of intervention in that country, the North American Army withdrew, defeated, culminating one of the most important events of the 20th century. The war brought death, destruction, and pain. But it also opened the door to significant changes worldwide. Amid the movements of sexual liberation, defense of human rights, and a lot of rock music, the animalists opened up space.
I want to say that we should give equal consideration to the interests of all beings that have interests, all beings, for example, that can feel pain, irrespective of their species, just as everybody now agrees we should give equal consideration to the interests of human beings, irrespective of their race or sex. So it's that kind of equality that I want to argue for.
In 1975, the Australian philosopher Peter Singer published Animal Liberation, one of the most important books on treating non-human animals and the ethical questions about our species. Singer's words were forceful and still resonate today in the struggle of hundreds of people advocating for animal rights.
There are no good reasons, scientific or philosophical, for denying that animals feel pain. If we do not doubt that other humans feel pain, we should no doubt that other animals do so too.
As if the pain humans have caused ourselves for centuries was not enough, we drag millions of animals into suffering to satisfy our desires. Animal liberation was 48 years ago, and is still today one of the great causes defended by Peter Singer. My name is Nicolás Ibargüen. I am a journalist, environmentalist, and I love nature. But above all, I am convinced that we must change the relationship we have with the earth.
I want to start this conversation by understanding what is practical ethics.
Well, in a sense, ethics has always been practical, but when I started studying ethics in the 60s, it had lost its practical edge. It was a theoretical conversation about the meanings of moral terms and whether ethics can be objectively true or false. So when I started doing it after a while in the late 1960s and 70s, I was very active in the student movement and the radical movement of that time. And there were starting to be a few people who were saying, look, ethics should have something to say to these issues, to the war in Vietnam, to racial discrimination in the American South, to a whole lot of other questions. And in fact, historically, ethics did say things about practical issues, but it was necessary to revive that. And so practical ethics is the application of ethical thinking to real life, to things that make a difference to the world and to the way we live. And that's all it is, a very simple and, in a way, very traditional concept that just needed to be reborn.
Why do you get interested in this? I mean, I know your parents are German, right?
Austrian.
Well, Austrian, and yeah. They escaped from Nazi occupation.
Yeah.
In that period, right. In Australia. So I guess your childhood, you spent it in Australia, right?
I was born in Australia, yes. Yeah, I spent my whole Australia.
So, yeah. I mean, tell me a little bit about how you got interested in these issues.
Well, I don't think my interest particularly had to do with the Holocaust, although often people try to trace the influence of that. I think it had more to do with the fact that I was an undergraduate in the 1960s, that Australia was involved in the war in Vietnam as an American ally, that we were becoming more concerned about issues of racism and also sexism, women's movement. Abortion was a big issue when I was an undergraduate. So I was involved in those issues, and I was also interested in philosophy. I was studying philosophy, as well as other things, but in the end I focused on the philosophy. And I thought it should have something to say about these other issues that I'm interested in. I never wanted to do philosophy in the sense of solving puzzles that would have no impact in the world, right? So you were sitting at the chess set, you know. I sometimes compare some questions in philosophy to like a chess puzzle, you know, how can white mate in two moves? And I never wanted to do that kind of philosophy. I always wanted to do philosophy that has an impact on the world.
So how you end up connecting issues like, the war, like big human issues that, of course, had a lot to do with ethics. How do you start to get interested in applying these to other living beings?
Well, that only happened when I was a graduate student at Oxford. I didn't really think about animal issues at all as an undergraduate. So it wasn't until 1970 when I had a chance conversation with a Canadian graduate student who was a vegetarian that challenged me to think about my own eating of meat and the moral status of animals, which I'd never really taken seriously as a serious issue before then. That will sound strange to you perhaps, but you know, in 1970 you never did meet a vegetarian. I mean, there just weren't any in the Western world. There were Hindus, I suppose, and there might have been occasional people who didn't eat meat because they thought it was bad for their health, but I hadn't really had a serious conversation with a vegetarian who had reasons for not eating animals that were to do with their suffering and their moral status. That was extremely rare to have that sort of position. So, as I say, he challenged me to justify why I was eating animals. I had to learn more about how animals were treated because I didn't know anything much about that. I assumed that they all had pleasant lives out in the fields before they were killed, but in fact already there were factory farms confining thousands of animals. So I learnt more about that and I decided that I couldn't go on eating them.
This was the 1960s, right?
No, it was 1970, actually. The meeting occurred sometime in the second half, maybe, I don't know, November or October, November of 1970.
It was definitely pretty rare. I mean, Western diet was totally full of animal meat and animal protein, and no one was asking these questions. I myself am from Colombia, and my whole culture is about eating meat. And unfortunately, it's one of those 8 countries that still they have these festivals around torturing animals, which is a bullfight.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, so, and I became vegetarian at a very early age as well, and I was a rare, a rare person within my society, my family and my school and everything onwards. So for you, being a philosopher, talking about these issues, which, I mean, of course, it was hard to meet people that were vegetarian and on their daily lives, but you were talking about it publicly and you wrote this book. And how was your personal experience having to confront this status quo of talking about an issue that at that time was rare and weird?
Yeah, but I wasn't completely alone because the Canadian that I mentioned had some other friends, a couple of other Canadians, but also some British students. So there was a group of people who I got introduced to who were vegetarians and concerned about animals. Maybe there was half a dozen or something like that.
But were they doing something about it publicly?
Three of them were editing a collection of articles, which was eventually published as a book called Animals, Men and Morals, which I see as a sort of pioneering work in the animal movement. It was published before animal liberation. And in fact, the first thing I wrote that I mentioned in The Year of Your Birth was a review of that book for the New York Review of Books to try to get some attention to it. So, yeah, they weren't actually doing more than that. And once I got involved, I organized a little public demonstration in one of the main streets of Oxford. We got a church there to give us permission to use its courtyard out on the street, and there was an organization called Compassion in World Farming, which is now a big organization but was tiny then, and they had some models of hens in cages, like paper mache hens in the cages that hens are in, to show people how crowded they are, and a veal calf in a crate. So that was the first kind of public demonstration of factory farming that I was involved in. So there was some activity then that started. But
it wasn't for you to confront society with these issues.
Well, I mean, you know, I was trying to, but then my main way of confronting society was to write about it, of course, in the New York Review of Books article and then in Animal Liberation. Once Animal Liberation was published, then I rapidly became a sort of a public figure, a representative of that then quite small and radical movement that was trying to confront society.
How bad was the pushback? Because, yeah, you indeed became this big figure inspiring a lot of these groups and organizations dedicating themselves to fight for animal rights. How big was the pushback? I mean, because there's industry and there's a lot of interests behind this very powerful industry of raising.
There was, but at the time they didn't take it very seriously. You know, the most common negative response to it was ridicule, you know, it was treated as if it was a joke, you know, or all animals are equal, you know, that's absurd, you know, I can't slap a mosquito, and just sort of try to laugh it off. The industry didn't really get mobilized against it for some years when it realized it had to take it seriously. But there was a positive response as well, which was encouraging. There were quite a few people who said, yes, I've always thought this, but, you know, I thought I was crazy. I didn't really dare talk about it because everybody else would have laughed. So there was quite a positive response from those people too.
And, I mean, it's been, 45 years since then? And, mm-hmm. Of course, things have changed a lot in terms of, like, it's now mainstream, in a way, being vegan and to talk about these issues, even in countries like mine, like Latin America, mm-hmm. where there's a big culture of eating animals. There is more understanding. But still, we are a small minority. People that are talking about these issues and people mm-hmm. are trying to do something about it and people that are protesting against it. And even, there are even laws here in the States condemning people that are actually raising these issues and filming.
Well, it's a filming in factory farms that is... The ag gag laws is illegal. I mean, there's no laws about talking about it, and there is complete freedom of expression to talk about it. And I think, in fact, that most of the ag gag laws will get struck down by the Supreme Court. I think they're not constitutional.
You think?
And some already have been. It's very difficult for the state legislatures to frame laws in ways that the courts are not going to strike down as violations of the First Amendment.
But they keep coming up.
They come up in the states that are dominated by factory farming, yeah. I mean, they don't come up in California, but they come up in Iowa or North Carolina, or yeah, exactly, places like that. Yeah.
But you think they're going to be struck down?
So far, there's no... When people have appealed them and taken them to higher courts, my understanding is that none of them have survived so far, but the police will still use them. They still intimidate you because the police can still... If a particular law hasn't been declared unconstitutional, the police can still arrest you. They can jail you while you wait for trial or something, and then you might be convicted, and then you have to have an appeal and so on. So it's still a deterrent. I'm not saying that it's not a deterrent to people doing what they used to do, but nobody who's continued to fight the laws through the courts, to my understanding, is still in prison or anything like that.
Still, I mean, veganism has grown and laws and certain improvements in animal welfare. But still, we kill over 60 billion animals, land animals, I think, or something.
Yeah.
Do you, I mean, and there's factory farming is bigger than ever and more powerful than ever. And despite the veganism movement and animal welfare movements and organizations spending a lot of money to try to raise awareness about these issues, do you see a world where eventually factory farming and the way we treat other living beings in this planet to eventually, can we create that society? Are we capable of creating that society?
I think we're capable of doing it. I think we'll be assisted by technology that produces foods that are either plant-based or cellular, that are meat-like. I think that will help to advance the speed of the process. But I certainly think we're capable of it. I just think it's still going to take a long time. It's not going to happen overnight or even in a year or two.
I know, I mean, of course, in all your books, and people have to read your books to really understand this, what I'm asking. But in a nutshell, how do you argument that human animals have the same rights of other animals?
So firstly, I don't really base my argument on rights, because I think it's difficult to say what rights even humans have, let alone what rights animals have. And I base it on equal consideration of interests. So my argument is simply that animals, not all animals, but many animals, are capable of feeling pleasure and pain. They're sentient beings. And if a being can feel pain, then its interest in not feeling pain should count just as much as the interest of any other being in not feeling a similar quantity of pain or a similar type of pain. The fact that the being is of a different species from us is not a morally relevant factor in trying to decide how much weight to give that pain. And there's a parallel there with anti-racist or anti-sexist movements that say the fact that a being is of a different race or a different sex is not a reason for giving less weight to the interests of that being.
In your book, Animal Liberation, you argue a big argument against animal testing. There's a lot of people pushing back, because they say that it's necessary for improving human health, and it's a necessity. What do you say about it?
So my position on animals, the use of animals in research, is a little different from that of many people in the animal movement, because I'm not an absolutist about it. I do take account of the consequences. So I think that the vast majority of experiments done on animals are not justifiable, because they inflict significant harms on animals for very little gain for humans. But, you know, at least in theory, you can imagine experiments that do produce big gains, both for humans and for non-human animals, and they could be justifiable. As I say, my principle is equal consideration of interests, and if the interests of whoever will be helped by the experiment outweigh the interests of the animals, and there's no other way of helping the people who need help, like people who are suffering from some disease, let's say, then it's at least possible that the experiment can be justified. But as I say, most animal experimentation is not, because it doesn't give that equal consideration to the interests of animals. It just sees them as kind of laboratory tools that you can do whatever you like to.
I was reading something about you, and so I don't know if it was you or someone else that calls you a hedonistic utilitarian.
I am a hedonistic utilitarian, yes. I do call myself that, yeah.
You call yourself that?
Yeah, I am. So a utilitarian is somebody who thinks that the right action is the one that produces the best consequences for all beings affected, and understands best consequences in terms of improving the welfare or well-being of all of those affected. And a hedonistic utilitarian says, by well-being we mean maximizing the surplus of happiness over unhappiness, or pleasure over pain.
Back in like 2015, I think you basically had a talk about a coming pandemic because of the way we treat animals, and then this happened, right? But I don't think we learned a lot about that. I mean, we still treat animals the same way. We still, there's wet markets and there's factory farming and there's... Do you think that unless we stop big industries and factory farming and wet markets and stuff like that, do you think other big pandemics can come?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not alone in that now. I mean, the Center for Disease Control and many other medical authorities have warned that the majority of the new viruses come from animals. And a factory farm is like, if you wanted to create new viruses, you would put 20,000 animals in a single shed and crowd them together and weaken their immune systems by stressing them a lot. And then you would have workers walk among them and pick up the dead ones and so on. That would be how you would get new viruses and spread them into the community. And that's exactly what factory farms do. So, yes, I think it's very likely that we will get more viruses out of factory farms, and possibly more deadly ones too.
Unless we change that.
Yeah, unless we change that, that's right. Yeah. But so far, as you say, we're not changing it.
There's another pretty, there's some controversy around some of the things that you say. And one that I found really interesting that I wanted to discuss with you was, you mentioned that parents should be able to decide on the fate of a kid with big disabilities, mm-hmm. very bad disabilities.
Yeah.
Can you explain that to me?
Yes, I don't think it's all that difficult to understand because firstly, at least in this country, most people support the idea that a pregnant woman should be able to have prenatal diagnosis to show whether a child has a disability, and if it does show that she should be able to terminate the pregnancy. So, one thing that I actually agree with people who are against abortion about is that birth doesn't make a huge difference. If you're able to perform an abortion on a fetus at 6 or 7 months because the fetus has a disability, how is that different from ending the life of a newborn infant because the newborn infant has a severe disability? After all, some infants are born prematurely and they're actually less developed than a seven-month-old fetus. So I think we already accept the ending of lives of human beings with disability, but prenatally. We also accept the ending of lives of humans with disabilities by withdrawing medical support, turning off respirators from very badly damaged babies, for example. So I'm just saying, look, if we're prepared to make those decisions, and I think we're right to make those decisions, they're tough decisions to take, but we should make them, then why shouldn't we allow parents who discover that their child has a severe disability only after birth to also make a decision that they feel is in the best interest of their child and the best interest of their family?
But at what point is not good to be able to make that decision? Because let's say they discover this a little later on, not right after birth.
Well, it's hard to give any definite deadline. I think it's much better to do it as soon as possible after birth. But of course, you're right. Maybe they don't discover the disability that early on. I think it does depend on the circumstances, how severe the disability really is. Obviously, for parents, how attached they are to the child, what the child's level of awareness is, if the child has any level of awareness at all. I think that's relevant. So I can't give you a precise answer to that question.
What's your take on euthanasia?
I support voluntary euthanasia or medical assistance in dying. That is also, more recently, that has been implemented in most of Australia, not yet in all of Australia.
In Australia, so you can actually have your decide on your own fate in Australia legally?
Yes, my brother-in-law did it just a couple of months ago. He had terminal cancer and he used the law and was able to take a drug, which meant that he fell asleep and didn't wake up.
That's interesting. We should do that everywhere.
Yeah, but you have that in Colombia, I understand. Your court decided that, right?
Well, right now there's conversation around it.
Yeah, and it exists here in California as well. It exists in all the way up the west coast, in California, Oregon, Washington, Montana, and right across Canada. And it's spreading across the United States now, too. And it's spreading in Europe, actually. Spain recently passed a law. So even, countries that are at least nominally Catholic, Portugal looks like it's going to pass a law soon. And some of the other countries like the Netherlands and Belgium have had these laws for decades.
How is it morally justified?
It's morally justified because it's not wrong to kill somebody who is competent and decides that they want to die and ask you for help in dying. And they've made that decision carefully. They've had a cooling off period to make sure that it's not just a temporary desire. I don't think it's wrong to kill somebody in those circumstances who makes a reasonable, carefully considered request to end their life. Bad about killing people is people who want to go on living and can have prospects for a good life.
Can you explain to us what speciesism is?
Speciesism is a bias in favor of one's own, usually one's own species, or maybe people have biases in favor of dogs rather than pigs, for instance. That's also a kind of speciesism. But it's a bias that leads you to take more seriously the interests of members of the favored species over similar interests of the species that you don't favor. And so it's a bias that makes us think that it's okay to do things to other animals that we wouldn't do to humans, that humans all are equal and have basic rights, but animals don't have any of these rights, or we don't have to take into account their interests. And we can do all sorts of things to animals we can't do to humans. And also, of course, that it's okay to treat pigs in ways we would never treat dogs. They're all forms of speciesism.
Talking about a lot about poverty and how ethics and morals apply in our society, in our capitalistic society, how there's like all of these widespread, too many rich people, too many poor people, and a small percentage of rich people having a lot of wealth. So morally and ethically, how do you see this inequality in our society?
No, I think society should have less inequality, but I don't really focus very much on that question because I don't know how to change that. You know, I don't know how you would get laws passed which, you know, obviously in theory we should have higher taxes on the rich, but the rich, particularly here in the United States, exercise disproportionate amounts of influence on politics, so it's very hard to get those changes through. I favour them, I hope that they will eventually succeed, but my focus has rather been on what we can do, despite the fact that we live in this very unequal world. And those of us who are fortunate enough to live in affluent societies and have enough and more than enough to meet our basic needs, we're also part of the inequality because we are, you know, maybe we're not the top 1% of the world, but we're probably the top 10%. And so I asked the question, what can we do about that now? You know, I don't have the power to change the law in the United States or in Australia, but I do have the power to make donations to organisations that are effectively helping people in extreme poverty. And that's what I do, and that's why I gave away the $1 million award that the Bert Gruen Institute gave to me, because...
You're giving it away?
I have already given away
all of
it. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, because, you know, it wouldn't have made a huge difference to my life. I can already meet all my needs from the income that I'm earning, but it can make a huge difference to people in poverty, and it can also, some of it I gave to organisations reducing animal suffering, trying to fight factory farming or persuade more people to become vegetarian or vegan. So I think there are lots of good things that you can do that if you're already, as I say, at the income level where you can meet your basic needs, you don't need.
Are you not optimistic or not?
I think that in the long run we have got better at making moral progress, at helping people in need. And I'm somewhat optimistic that that will continue, but there are certainly serious threats like climate change and possibly now in the light of what's going on in Ukraine, larger wars. So I'm cautiously optimistic.
Cautiously optimistic, depending on the day they ask you, or...
No, just because I don't know what's going to happen about climate change or war.
This interview was recorded on June 26, 2020. Elemental is a co-production by the team from Nanoficción, Excel Content Studios, and Nicolás Ibargüen. The interview was edited by Juan Camilo Hernández and Miguel Reyes. Mixing and sound design were done by Valentina Fonseca. The introductory and closing song is by Manuela Mejía, and the handpan performance is by Felipe Ibargüen. If you have comments or suggestions, please write to us on our Instagram at Podcast Elemental. If you enjoy our work, help us spread the word by recommending it to friends or family who may find it useful or interesting. Don't forget to click the follow button and the notification bell for the Elemental Show to stay updated on new episodes. Thank you very much.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more.
and is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.